Now, in your comments on the British style system at this time, you mention in your book that there had been some hope that the staff test system might have changed, either during or shortly soon after the end of the war, but that, and I quote, vested interests proved to be too strong. I wondered exactly what vested interests you were referring to and how they operated.
Oh my gosh, I don't know that I can remember. Mind you, my memory is not what it used to be with the years.
Now, during this period of staff work, you occasionally used the Royal Flying Corps people that were attached to your corps in reconnaissance duties. How useful, as a part of the intelligence system on the Western Front, how important and useful a part do you think the Royal Flying Corps squadrons played?
Very, very valuable indeed. I used to fly with the squadron commander and flew right over the our own front line, over as far as the German front line. To get an idea of the state of the country, state of the ground, especially before any proposed operations or attack. And it was extremely valuable.
Right. The next major operation you were involved in was the German gas attack on Nieuport. That must have been a particularly horrible experience. I think this was the first time the Germans had used mustard gas, was it not? What do you remember of the impressions that the gas and the effects the gas had on the British forces?
Well, the thing I have now in my mind was the worry of getting some reply to it, and that was getting improvising gas masks to save our troops in the future, and all the worry we had in getting the necessary materials and chemicals. Very little was known about it, and that's in my recollection of what the thing was then.
Did you
It
actually
was
witness the gas attack?
no, I didn't see
I
the
see.
clouds of gas.
During this period also, you met General Nollet, who in the post-war years became French Minister of War. I wonder if you remember any of the details of that meeting.
Well, I do, because he presented me with the Legion of Honor and the Croix de... Wait a minute. He recommended me for the Legion of Honor and the Croix de Guerre, and he actually pinned the Croix de Guerre onto my uniform, because he, as the local French commander, was entitled to present it to me. Legion of Honor was had to go to some higher authority to be approved, and I was given that by an army commander later on, by a French army commander later on.
Now, towards the end of 1917, you were appointed to First Army HQ as General Staff Officer 2, GSO 2. And you worked there under the command of Lord Horne, as he later became General Horne, as he then was. From your contact with General Horne, what kind of impression did you get him? get of him? What sort of impact did he make on you?
He was a silent man, but undoubtedly a very strong character, and he had a great impact. He was a gunner officer, and he had a great impact on the use of artillery in the support of the other arms,
mm-hmm.
especially in trench warfare. In fact, he devised the use of the creeping barrage to support infantry attacks.
Could you tell me in a little detail how a creeping barrage was laid by the artillery?
The creeping barrage was designed to lay a line of bursting shells to start with on the first objective of our own infantry, attacking infantry, that's to say the enemy's frontline trench, and it would creep away forward so as to allow our infantry to move to attack and run into the enemy's defending infantry, clear of our artillery fire, so that our barrage would creep forward at a pace suitable for our attacking infantry to keep up with it, but of course just clear of the bursting shells. This barrage would creep forward at so many, whatever it might be, 100 yards a minute, or even less, so as to give our infantry time to clear the enemy's trench, then it move forward, and so on, over the supporting trench and over the reserve trenches. And it might creep forward like this for 100 yards, 1,000 yards, and so on. And the shells might be laid down depending on the number of guns you had available. You might have a shell bursting at intervals of 20 yards over a front of thousands of yards, as I say, depending entirely on how many guns you had available to do it. So that is the creeping barrage. And
was it difficult to lay by the artillery?
No. Once they'd been trained to do it, the guns were scientifically laid and sighted, and elevation gradually increased. They knew exactly how to do it, to creep the barrage, creep forward 100 yards at a time at certain speed.
Mm-hmm.
And well-trained divisional artillery, the artillery of several divisions would do it in line, and well trained, you could see it. You could see this line of bursting shells going forward extremely regularly.
What other main kinds of barrages were there at the time?
There's one thing I might mention now, and that is wire cutting. All these trenches were defended with a line of barbed wire, sometimes a thick belt of barbed wire in front of them. And in the very early attacks, this barbed wire had to be cut either by hand or by what were known as Bangalore torpedoes, which were carried up in the very early in the war by sappers and exploded. Well, then it was discovered that artillery fire, shrapnel burst very low, would blow lanes through this barbed wire. And that was a recognized way of cutting the wire with artillery fire. they would cut a series of lanes through the barbed wire through which the infantry could get. And so that was another use of the artillery fire in attack. What was the next?
We were going on to tell me about some of the other kinds of barrages which were used. You mentioned the defensive barrage.
Oh, yes. The defensive barrage would be put down to prevent the enemy attacking our own frontline trench. A line of bursting shells would be fired along the whole of your, in front of your own frontline trench at a safe distance, 100 or 200 yards. If it was the moment when it became clear that the enemy were attacking, and there was usually a signal for this, a firework to be fired from our own frontline trench, a red rocket or a red firework of some sort was fired up into the air to show an enemy attack coming, in addition, of course, to a telephone message. But in case the telephone wire was cut, they hadn't got wireless everywhere in those days, but so there was a signal to bring down the defensive barrage. And this defensive barrage was a continuous belt of fire in front of our front line through which the enemy attacking troops had to come.
And what about counter-battery fire? How was that employed?
Counter-battery fire was again organized by our own artillery to neutralize the enemy artillery in the event of the enemy artillery becoming very active, either just harassing our trenches or our troops. Our own artillery would start counter-battery fire, and that was so organized that every hostile enemy battery would have a certain number of our own guns firing at it at intervals for a certain period of time, depending on the amount of ammunition available. So if counter-battery fire was ordered, say, on the whole divisional front, mean that every enemy gun on that front would have a crash of artillery fire coming down on it to try and neutralize it and stop it firing. And so that was really counter-battery fire.
I believe that at the beginning of the war, one of the things which was apparent was that the German artillery were initially a good deal more effective and impressive than the British artillery, and that British artillery practice improved a good deal as the war went on. I take it these kind of barrages we're talking about now were refinements of technique that developed with the war.
Oh, yes. Very much so. For example, the creeping barrage was entirely a development of the war. As I say, I think that was invented by Lord Horne when he was a brigadier commanding the artillery of the division.
Were there any other refinements in artillery practice that were apparent, apart from those we've already mentioned?
Nothing.
The next major operation you were involved with was in the spring of 18, the first of the German spring offensives in March, that attack which was south of the First Army which you were serving with.
Yes.
Which required you to move units very rapidly south to the Nieppe-Vimy Ridge,
yes.
Vimy Ridge area. I wondered how those transfers were organized and what kind of problems arose during them.
The problems of carrying out large-scale troop moves involve road and rail. Great use was made of the French railways behind our front line, there was usually enough rolling stock for a fair amount of railway moves, and one knew pretty well exactly how many divisions could be moved by rail in a given time, say in 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. And when there was a real emergency and it was a case of moving 4, 5, or 6 divisions from one part of the front to say 40 or 50 miles away to another part of the front where the Germans were starting to deliver a very heavy attack, you had to make quick decisions as to how many you could, what was the quickest way of moving them, how many you could move by rail, how many had to go by road. And if you had usually the perhaps more than one road that could be used, there was usually a coastal road and another inland road that you could use, and you had to make quick decisions as to the quickest way of getting divisions, depended whether they were where they were billeted or whether you had to take divisions out of the trench line spread your troops more thinly in the trench line and take a division out and move it down. And this required very complicated thinking and working out as to get the maximum number of troops on the move as quickly as possible when there was a real emergency.
On